Pilgrims and Plymouth Rock in school. But what happened in those years between the time the colonists arrived in the so-called New World and the events leading up to the Revolutionary War? Scott Wiedenthal, who was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize writing about migratory birds, has written a new book that traces those 2.5 centuries. It's called The First Frontier, The Forgotten History of Struggle, Savagery, and Endurance in Early America. Wiedenthal explores the complicated and often violent relationship between the native Indian populations and the European settlers as they battled over land. Wiedenthal grew up in the frontier that he writes about along the Appalachian Mountains. He's written more than 24 books, is an active bird migration field researcher, and joins us once again on Radio Times. And Scott Wiedenthal, always nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your new book.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Take us from migratory birds to this particular book, which goes back certainly to those early days of colonists coming to what was the New World.
Well, I admit it seems like a bit of a stretch for somebody who writes normally about natural history, but I think anybody who's interested in natural history probably has the same hankering that I did, you know, growing up in the mountains of Pennsylvania, wanting, you know, wishing that you could have seen this vast untouched, as we thought in those days, this vast untouched continent that was, you know, brimming with life, passenger pigeons and wolves and mountain lions and such. And of course, we realize now that it was not an untouched land. It was not a trackless wilderness. There were millions of people living here. But it was still a very different world than the one we have today. And, you know, growing up in the mountains of Pennsylvania, you know, driving roads like Bloody Spring Road, which was named for an Indian attack in the 1750s, I've just always been fascinated by the frontier. And about 6 years ago, I just decided to plunge into it and discovered that as interested as I had always been, I knew very, very little about it. I mean, this, I call it the forgotten history. I mean, even those of us who profess an interest in it, I think, understand very, very little about what actually happened.
Well, just to underscore what you said, this was, in a sense, not wilderness, even though I think many of us think of it that way. And there were something like 3.8 million people living in this part of what would become the United States of America.
Right. There's been a lot of scholarship in the last couple of years on just exactly how many people lived in pre-contact North America, and the numbers vary widely. But there were probably at least 1 million people living along the eastern seaboard. In fact, you can really get a sense of this when you read the accounts of early explorers like John Smith, who in 1614 was coasting along the shoreline of Maine and New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and talking about what a beautiful place it was, of all the four corners of the earth that he'd seen, the place where he'd want to spend his life. But the problem was there were just so damned many people that everywhere he went, there were these legions of tall, goodly formed people. In 1524, Verrazano in Narragansett Bay talked about the cornfields in the Narragansett Nation stretching for 75 miles inland. This was a densely populated part of the world. And, of course, it must have seemed like a cruel joke of Providence that, you know, that God had led the Christian settlers to this new land, and it was populated with people that would prevent them from getting even any kind of a beachhead. But, of course, what happened was that Providence changed the rules in the early 17th century, and disease wiped out
about... How many Indians died as a result of what, smallpox and diseases brought from Europe?
Exactly. We don't. The estimates are between 90% and 98% of the population was decimated in a matter of just a couple of years. You know, I mentioned that John Smith was exploring in 1614 and found so many people. By 1619, about 90% of the human population along the coast of Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts had been decimated in what's called the Great Dying, and that opened up the land. The Pilgrims would not have been able to settle in Plymouth had the Wampanoag not been decimated by disease. And so they moved into what seemed to them a conveniently cleared land, a providentially cleared land, took over the old farm sites of the Indians, in many cases plundered the food stores that were still left there, and got them through those first hard years when they would otherwise not have been able to.
Well, and it seems not surprisingly, these 2.5 centuries were a fight over land.
And a fight between people who deep down at their very core thought the land was theirs. And in many respects were right. I mean, people who were born here, I mean, as late as the mid-18th century when the Seven Years' War broke out, you had Indian leaders like Scowraday talking to the provincial government in Pennsylvania and talking about we who came out of this ground. And he didn't just mean the Iroquois and the Lenape and the Shawnee. He meant the Pennsylvanians as well. But yes, I mean, there was this battle for land. And that really took form particularly in the English colonies, because the colonial model that England was pursuing was to create an agrarian society with wave after wave after wave of colonists coming in, occupying the land, moving into unoccupied land so that the frontier kept pushing farther and farther to the west and to the north. The French had a different model. They were interested in saving souls and in commerce. The Spanish had a very different model. But the English brought so many people in that conflict and bloody conflict was really almost inevitable.
What's so interesting is, as you tell this story through the experience and the eyes of a number of people who had been captured by Indians, had written diaries, had correspondence about the kind of intimacy of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Although you raise a good point, this is almost entirely a European perspective. And this
exactly.
is the hardest thing, the most frustrating thing for anybody who's writing about this period is the paucity of native voices, because you were dealing with primarily an oral culture. And I make the point in the book that for every anguished letter from a terrified settler on the frontier, for every council minute from the provincial council in Pennsylvania, there were native echoes in Onondaga, in Iroquois, in Senecomaca, along the Chesapeake coast, but they've been lost to history. So we really have a very jauntist view of how this went. But yes, I mean, there's some fascinating people, some fascinating characters in those early days.
And I do want to get to some of those characters, but something else that you write here, for almost two centuries along the eastern frontier, their sharpest division from a colonial perspective was not racial, Caucasian versus American Indian, but religious.
That's right. And that's, we tend to think of ethnic differences and racial differences as being self-evident. But in those days, people really did not, especially Europeans, did not really see it that way. There was no sense of unified European identity. You know, an Englishman would no sooner consider himself an equal or a peer of an Italian or a German than he would of a dog, necessarily. The divisions were not white versus Indian. It was religious. It was Christian versus pagan. And you see this time and time again for the first two centuries of colonization. And the same thing worked on the other side. An Oneida in New York or a Mohawk would probably be less likely to consider a Catawba, one of their hereditary enemies in the Southeast, as part of this unified, Indian identity. They're probably much more likely to see their English neighbors as more like them than the Catawba.
But I wonder how they looked at each other, whether they saw race as opposed to religion. Might be hard to know.
Exactly, and that comes back to what we know and what we don't know. What's interesting is that the self-identification among the colonists as white is something that appears to have grown out of the Carolina colonies in the South, where many of the colonists originally had come from Barbados. They were Englishmen by way of Barbados, where they had grown up in a plantation system using African slave labor. So there was that white versus black dichotomy. Interestingly enough, the identification of Indians as red, which is something that's deeply offensive to natives today, appears to have grown out of a self-identification among Indians in the Southeast in the late 16th and early in the late 1600s and early 1700s, because a lot of Southern Indian cultures had a red-white duality between good and evil, up and down, and as the whites were identifying themselves as white, it seems that the Indians may have started identifying themselves as red.
Your book begins with the Hochstetler family. They had an apple farm. This was September 1757.
Well, the Hochstetlers were part of the very first Amish settlement in North America. If you've driven west on I-78 just past Hamburg, you've gone right through the middle of the Hochstetler farm. In fact, today, Roadside America, that old slightly kitschy roadside attraction, sits in the middle of the Hochstetler farm.
Really?
But in 1757, the Hochstetlers they had apples and they had a lot of other things growing there. And it was September. It was a time when many of the surrounding farm families would come together to help bring in the apple harvest. And in the pre-dawn hours the next day, a mixed group of Shawnee and Lenape attacked the Hochstetler farm, set fire to the building. And this is actually an incident that has a lot of resonance today with Mennonite and Amish history, because Mr. Hochstetler had come from the old country. He was Amish. He was a pacifist. And as the Indians attacked, his two teenage sons picked up their hunting rifles to defend the family. And he said, we have not come this far to abandon our principles. And he wouldn't let them fight back. He herded everybody into the basement. The house was set on fire. They broke open casks of cider and splashed cider on the roof beams to keep from being burned to death. They watched out a small window in the basement, and as dawn came, the attacking Indians began to slip away, and so they broke out the window and began to crawl out. Mrs. Hochstetler got stuck part way, and one of the Indians came back to pick up peaches and saw them. And so Mrs. Hochstetler and the two youngest children were killed. Mr. Hochstetler and the two teenage boys were taken captive and marched off into the wilderness. It, part of this great diaspora of people that were taken from the colonies, taken captive, some of whom suffered horrific deaths, some of whom managed to escape, as Mr. Hochstetler eventually did, and many of whom were adopted into the Indian tribes that had taken them, as both of the boys were. And the boys found it very difficult in later years to decide whether to remain with their adoptive families, whom they loved very much, or to come back to their birth families back in the colonies.
In fact, you tell a story which we might not have justice to before this break, a guy named John Giles, who was also taken from his family by Indians.
That's right. John Giles he's been dead for a long time. He was 10 or 11 years old when he was taken captive in the 1680s in Pemaquid, Maine, taken captive by the Maliseet. And unlike the two Hochstetler boys who became adopted, loved members of their Indian families, Giles was held as a slave for the 16 years that he was, or 10 years that he was with the Indians. A very rough life, and yet he was a plucky little kid, and he survived horrific frostbite, abuse.
Terrible winters, right?
Terrible winters. And these were winters that the Indian families suffered right along with them. They were traveling through their winter hunting camps in the Gaspé Peninsula. His feet froze so badly one time that all of the skin on both feet sloughed off like socks. And because he was a slave, he was responsible for his own care, and so he had to scoot around in his butt, putting balsam spruce fir on his feet until they healed.
You mentioned religion, and his mother said, when she found out he had been taken captive, "I had rather follow you to your grave or never see you more in this world than that you should be sold to a Jesuit, for a Jesuit will ruin your body and soul."
Well, and that was a typical philosophy for many of the
worse
Puritans.
Than a Jesuit would take you.
Exactly. Well, they were both captured and taken to one of the large Abenaki outposts in Penobscot Bay, where a Jesuit priest tried to buy John Giles, probably out of the goodness of his heart, but it was considered a worse fate than death to be converted to Catholicism. And in fact, some of the European captives, some of the English captives that were taken at the Deerfield attack in 1704 in Massachusetts, one of them, Eunice Williams, eventually converted to Catholicism and married a Canadian Mohawk, to the eternal despair of her father, who realized that he had lost her not just in this life, but probably in the next one as well.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Scott Wiedenthal, our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a brand new book called The First Frontier, subtitled The Forgotten History of Struggle, Savagery, and Endurance in Early America. We're going to take that short break, continue our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Rowan University's Rohrer College of Business proudly supports WHYY. The Rohrer College of Business is one of five business schools in the nation to hold the prestigious AACSB accreditation for business and ABET accreditation for its Management Information Systems program. Rohrer's next MBA information session will be held at 6 p.m. on April 10th in Cherry Hill. 856-256-4024 or rowan.edu/MBA. Rowan University's Rohrer College of Business. Experience personal learning. Experience your future.
The singer Morley has traveled the world working with children in conflict zones and performing for people like Nelson Mandela and the Dalai Lama. Her latest and most personal album is called Undivided. We hear new music from Morley next time on Tell Me More.
They stood together under a tree in tall grass on TV.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Medford Lees, a Quaker-related community for those age 55-plus and home of the Barton Arboretum, proudly supports WHYY. On April 14th at 11 a.m., it's their annual Arboretum Lecture featuring horticulturalist and author David Culp. He will share how native plants harmonize with our natural environment and help create sustainable landscapes. Light lunch and arboretum tours follow the lecture. Information about this event and details about Medford Lees's communities at medfordlees.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Scott Weidensall. We're talking actually about the 2.5 centuries before the Revolutionary War and the cooperation, coexistence, and conflicts between Native peoples and the colonizers. That's the subject of his most recent book called The First Frontier. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. And just picking up the story of John Giles, so he's taken, essentially lives as a slave among the Indians.
That's right, and eventually was sold to a French family up in what's now New Brunswick. And again, he really despaired of this. He was afraid he'd never be able to find his way back to his family in Maine. But he was a plucky kid. He had an ability and a gift for language. He learned French as easily as he learned Maliseet. And within a matter of just a year or two, he'd gained the trust of the French family, which ran a farm and an outpost and a trading post along the river. And it was at a time when the first of these, you know, we talk about the French and Indian War. There were actually four French and Indian Wars, the first of these colonial imperial wars that were breaking out. And so the English colonists were attacking the French colonies in eastern Canada. And Giles was faced with this really wrenching decision. The English forces, the colonial forces, were marching in toward where he was being held. All he had to do was slip away and connect with the English and be taken back home. But the French family asked him to protect their property, protect their livelihood. And so he did. He left a note for the attacking English forces saying that the French family had treated him well, which they had.
Right.
He took the wife and the children of the French family. The French master was off in France at the time, and hid them off in the wilderness away from the attacking English forces. The English actually respected the note, didn't burn down the farm, and in response, the Frenchman, when he came back, actually offered to adopt Giles and make him his heir. Which, given the fact that this was a noble family, would have been quite a princely thing to do. But he said no. He really just wanted to go back home. And so more than 10 years after he was kidnapped, he found himself back in Boston again. Mm-hmm. Eventually went on to become an interpreter, a militia commander along the coast. And many years later, while he was commanding a militia outpost in the coast of Maine, his former slave master, the Maliseet man who had held him for many years in captivity, showed up at the door. And Giles must have been a remarkable man, because he wrote later that, "I made him very welcome." There was no bitterness. And he wrote an account of his time in captivity later in life. And it's really remarkable that, first of all, how candid it was and how little bitterness he had toward the Maliseet that had held him.
Well, I love the title, Memoir of Odd Adventures.
Yes.
Odd Adventures.
He was a very, very odd adventures. Somebody, historians have described it as part ethnography, part natural history, and part horror story to read his account.
Indeed. But in focusing on Indians that were killing, you know, colonial people or taking them captive, that there were reasons for this. And you write about the quote-unquote deceit and chicanery that was going on largely over land and who owned land, who controlled land.
That's right. And I don't want to give the impression that this was happening universally. There were areas like the coast of Maine where land deals were for the most part fairly honest, and you have to modify that by saying fairly honest.
Right.
But in other areas, Richard Waldron, for example, who was one of the early colonists in New Hampshire, he ran a trading post in the 17th century, and Waldron just had a well deserved reputation for dishonesty. He'd push his thumb down on the scale when he was weighing goods and claimed that his thumb only weighed a pound. And it eventually came back to bite him. Because when the Indians began sweeping the frontier, they singled Waldron out for particular revenge. They cut off his hand and asked him how much it weighed. Now they slashed their knives across his chest, saying, "I cross out my account," because he would refuse to cross out the accounts of Indians that had paid off their debts. They eventually forced him down onto his own sword and killed him. It was a long, slow burn for the most part. What often happened, though, is by the time the natives finally recognized the danger, it was too late. This happened in the early 1600s in Jamestown. It happened later in the 17th century in southern New England with King Philip's War. By the time they realized they were facing this seemingly endless flood tide of English colonists that were taking their land by any means, they had been so decimated by disease and warfare and cultural disillusion that they simply did not have the means to drive the English back off the continent and out of their land.
And part of this deceit and chicanery had to do with land and even these walking purchases, as they were described. Well, in fact, William Penn, of course, associated with these walking purchases.
Right, and Penn has a fairly well-deserved reputation for honesty, again, as far as it went. I mean, he never doubted for a moment that the Lenape would sell him as much land as he could possibly want. The idea that they would not sell him land never occurred to him, and of course he felt that he already owned everything from here far to the west because of royal decree. But when a purchaser and a seller would come to terms on what land was being sold, one of the ways that would be done would be that the two of them would walk across the land for a set length of time, stopping for a midday meal, stopping for a smoke. That worked fine if you were dealing with a fairly honest man like William Penn, but William Penn's sons were something else entirely. And Penn's sons, you know, we talk today about the walking purchase. We're
exactly
talking about one of the most infamous bits of land deceit in the colonial period, where they secretly plotted to hire the most adept, fit woods walkers and wood runners that they could. They secretly surveyed a route ahead of time. They set all this up with fraudulent documents that suggested that their father had actually purchased this land, and the Lenape argued vehemently for years that that had not been the case, but they finally agreed to have another walking episode to settle the whole thing. And what ended up happening, instead of just strolling gently across the landscape, you had men that were essentially professional runners who ran for days and ended up stealing thousands of square miles of eastern Pennsylvania. And this was one of the many insults that finally came back to bite the Pennsylvania colony during the Seven Years' War, during the French and Indian War, when the Lenape that had been forced out of southeastern Pennsylvania, forced into the Wyoming Valley and the upper Susquehanna, then forced further back into the Ohio country, finally had enough and turned on the English that had been their allies and their friends for many, many years.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, Scott Wiedensahl is our guest today on Radio Times. He's written something like 24 books. Is that possible?
It is.
Apparently it is. And his most recent one, and I should add that he's largely written about birds and migratory birds. This new book, a slight shift for him, and it's called The First Frontier, The Forgotten History of Struggle, Savagery, and Endurance in Early America. And it's about the 2.5 centuries before the Revolutionary War, what life was like here, especially on the East Coast of the United States, or what became the United States. This First Frontier, very different from the frontier that we associate with the American West. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Scott, you have in this book a map of Indian trails basically all over Pennsylvania. And it's, you know, it's just a crisscross of numerous trails covering what is, of course, now the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, that's right. And in fact, the difficulty if you were moving across this frontier was this was not a trackless frontier. You would get lost. People got lost because there were too many trails. Again, to get back to what we were talking about earlier, this was a heavily inhabited land before European colonization. In fact, it's interesting that in the area that probably most accurately qualifies as wilderness was western Pennsylvania, the Ohio River country, areas that were depopulated in the early 1600s because of disease outbreaks. In fact, many of the native societies that lived there were gone before the first Europeans set foot there because the disease propagated from one society to the next farther and farther back into the frontier. And then again later in the 1600s, these incredibly violent intertribal wars that are known today as the Beaver Wars over control of the fur trade coming out of the interior left large areas of the colonial frontier essentially depopulated, so that the wilderness actually was at its peak from probably the early 1600s until the early 1700s, when many refugee people from across the East, especially refugee Indian tribes, began moving into Western Pennsylvania and the Ohio country. It was empty land. They provided a buffer both for the Six Nation Iroquois to the north and also for the Pennsylvania colonists and the Virginia colonists to their east. And so you had, for example, the Tuscarora, which had been badly beaten in a war in the early 1700s with the English and Carolina colony, moved up and became actually eventually adopted members of the Iroquois. The remnants of the Susquehannock, many of the tribes around the Chesapeake Bay moved up into the Susquehanna Valley. And then many of the Iroquois themselves began moving into the Ohio country because it was incredibly rich land. It was a rich hunting ground out there. And it became a problem both for the power center here in Pennsylvania with the provincial government in Philadelphia and also for the power center in Iroquois at Onondaga, because these were people who were outside the control of either of those two governments, both the native Iroquois government in Onondaga and the Pennsylvania government here. Both of those sides, both the Iroquois and the Pennsylvanians, began to make common cause to bring these refugees, Indian refugees and Indian settlers under heel, and in an increasing number of English and Irish and Quaker and German immigrants that were moving into the Pennsylvania frontier.
Which is a perfect segue to a guy named Conrad Weiser. George Croghan,
mm-hmm.
and Andrew Montour.
Montour, from whence we get Montour County and Montoursville
exactly.
Central Pennsylvania.
And Weiser was a Moravian diplomat.
Well, he was Weiser was a German who had immigrated with his family from the Palatine in Germany, part of a huge wave of immigration coming out of Germany in the early 1700s. Moved with his family to New York and became an adopted member of the Mohawk. His family, he didn't get along with his father at all. And at age 16, his father sent him off to live with the Mohawk to learn the language. And he found he was much more comfortable living with the Mohawk than he was with his abusive father and a stepmother that he hated. Eventually, many of these German immigrants came to Pennsylvania and settled in the Talpahocken Valley of what's now northern Berks County. And Weiser found himself along the main road between the Six Nation Iroquois in New York and Philadelphia, and he became an interpreter for the Pennsylvania colony, became really their central diplomat in their dealings with the Six Nations and the other Indian tribes. He was not entirely an honest broker. He was his political philosophy was very much aligned with what was good for Pennsylvania and what was good for the Iroquois, which was not necessarily the same thing as what was good for the Lenape who actually lived here. And Weiser, to his shame, was involved in a number of land frauds over the years and land deals that were not in the best interest of the Lenape. But he was really central to what happened in the early colonial frontier, 1730s, 1740s, and 1750s.
But what we also see is obviously these people that straddled, I guess, several cultures. Andrew Montour, another example.
Yeah, he's probably, to me, the most haunting figure in the entire early frontier. He came from a line of French Iroquois interpreters. His mother, Madame Montour, was a renowned interpreter working. She was the official interpreter for the colony of New York. His uncle had that job before until he was assassinated on the orders of the Governor General of France. One of his aunts was married to a Miami in a French-leaning Miami in the Ohio River Valley. He was the kind of man who changed names and identities the way many of us change shirts. He was known as Andrew Montour, Andrew Satalehu, Andre Montour, French Andrew. He was too Indian to really be trusted by the colonists. He was too white to be trusted entirely by the Indians, who often thought that he was working against their interests, as he sometimes was. But he settled himself down. He tried to settle himself down at one point along the Susquehanna frontier, and apparently was trying to create a place that would have been a refuge for all these other cast-offs and in-betweens, refugees, people that didn't fit in quite one place or quite another, where he could become a proprietor along the lines in sort of a small way that William Penn had. And this was a dangerous, dangerous notion, both to the provincial government in Pennsylvania and to the Iroquois government in Onondaga, because, again, these were people that would have been out of control of both of those power centers, and so they colluded together to crush this man's dream. As I say in the book, it's really not much of a mystery why Andrew Montour drank as much as he did.
Indeed. Well, let me get some callers in on the conversation, then we'll get back to our story here. We have, looks like Randy from Westchester joining us on Radio Times. Randy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm really appreciating and really enjoying your show.
Thank you.
A question to your guest there. I'm wondering how much conflict there was within the confederation that Powhatan ruled or was chief of regarding whether they were struggling within the confederation to side with the French or the English. What is there any evidence that there was any kind of heavily leaning one way or the other? And how much, is that kind of a second part, how much has the Pocahontas issue been over-mythologized, and is there any evidence that that it was had more influence than we like to believe? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Randy, for calling into Radio Times. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, what Randy's talking about is the what's known as the Powhatan Confederacy along the Chesapeake Bay and the Tidewater in Virginia. This is where John Smith and the Jamestown settlers came in 1607. That was far, far, far away from the power centers of France. They really had no connection with France. In fact, the Spaniards were actually much more of a concern down there with the English. And that was one of these relationships that turned violent right from the start. The man that we know today as Powhatan had assembled about an 8,000 square mile confederacy known as Senecomaca that controlled much of the Chesapeake Tidewater in the western Chesapeake, and he didn't quite. I think they just didn't quite know what to make of these strange, smelly, rather hairy people that showed up. And this
would
is one
be
of
the Europeans.
These would be the English, yeah.
The English.
This is one of the points that I try to make in the book and I want to make today, is that because of the way we're taught history, we tend to see the natives in this, the Indians in this, as passive players. And these were sophisticated political operatives. They were sophisticated at diplomacy. They were making decisions based on the information they had available at the time and based on what appeared to be their own best interests. The story we're told about the Pilgrims, just to get off Powhatan for a moment, is that the friendly Wampanoag Indians took the Pilgrims in and taught them how to plant corn and shepherded them through that first bad winter. Well, the fact of the matter is the Wampanoag had been decimated by disease. Their leader Massasoit faced the Narragansett to the west, which were their traditional enemies, who'd been essentially untouched by disease. He needed allies, and so the English show up with this strange technology. Matchlock muskets seem awfully primitive to us today, but if you're shooting bows and arrows, they're a remarkable step forward. He saw the Pilgrims as potential military allies, and back down in Virginia with the Jamestown colonists, Powhatan just wasn't really quite sure what to make of them. They at times seemed like a minor irritant. At times they seemed like an arrogant threat. Unfortunately, by the time Powhatan and Opechancanough, who was his brother that succeeded him, eventually recognized the threat and tried to drive the English out starting in 1622, it was too late. Disease had decimated the native population, and there were just too many English.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. Randy, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We're talking with Scott Weidensahl today on Radio Times. He often writes about natural history. He's also written about a dozen books, the most recent one called The First Frontier. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yefim Bruntman joins the Philadelphia Orchestra for Bartok's Second Piano Concerto. Bruntman won a Grammy for his performance of this work. Also, Gilbert Varga conducts Stravinsky's Petrushka. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999. April 12th, 13th, and 14th at the Kimmel Center, Bruntman plays Bartok plus Petrushka with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Booth Bartolozzi Balderston Orthopedics, the 3 B's, support WHYY. As leaders in joint replacement, sports medicine, spine, and shoulder care, the physicians provide patients with personalized care and the latest treatment options available. At Pennsylvania Hospital, the nation's first hospital. More information about Booth Bartolozzi Balderston Orthopedics, the three Bs, available by phone at 800-789-PEN. 800-789-PEN.
The singer, Morley, has traveled the world working with children in conflict zones and performing for people like Nelson Mandela and the Dalai Lama. Her latest and most personal album is called Undivided. We hear new music from Morley next time on Tell Me More.
They stood together under a tree.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about some pieces of history with our guest Scott Wiedenthal, author of a new book called The First Frontier. It's subtitled The Forgotten History of Struggle, Savagery, and Endurance in Early America. And this is the 2.5 centuries before the Revolutionary War. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Scott, you were saying before the break that we should not think of the Indians that were living here as passive players at all when it comes to this history. And I made a little notation because a Seneca leader, we're jumping around in history here, but nonetheless, a Seneca leader said about George Washington, who had gone out to fight around Fort Duquesne in the western part of Pennsylvania, described George Washington as a good, mature man, but he had no experience.
Well, and that was true. I mean, George Washington at the time was in his early 20s. He was this kind of arrogant Virginian nobleman who managed to set off the first really truly global war, what we call the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War. He really didn't know what he was doing. The same Indian leader, Ta-Nehisi, described Fort Necessity, which was where Washington was going to make his stand against the French, as that pathetic little thing in the meadow. He had no respect for George Washington as a military leader.
Let me get back to our callers. We have, it looks like, Mike from New Jersey. And Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I have a quick question about the idea of slavery. You had mentioned that was a concept that may have come from the French in the West Indies, but where how did it find its way to the Northern tribe and that young fellow who was kidnapped and would think of fate worse than death and to be sold to the Jesuits?
Well, if I gave the impression that slavery was something that was brought to this country by the Europeans, then I did a disservice. Slavery was something that occurred in Indian society in pre-colonial times, in pre-settlement times. Although the concept of slavery was really different, it wasn't necessarily the kind of hereditary chattel slavery that we're used to thinking of today. But slavery is something that was almost universal among Indian tribes here. What was interesting, I devote a chapter of the book to the Indian slave trade in the Southeast, and what was different was that the Indians might take you captive and might hold you for the rest of your life as a slave, or you might transition through adoption into a full and respected member of the tribe, or you might be sold to somebody else. You might eventually even be given your freedom. In the 1600s, the English that settled in Carolina. As I said before, many of these were planters that had come from Barbados, where there was already a slave plantation culture, and they created an international slave trade focusing not on African slaves, but on Indian slaves. African slaves were brought to this country very early. I mean, shortly after Jamestown was founded, the first Africans were brought there in slavery. So that has a very long and unfortunate history. But in the 1600s and early 1700s, the one of the economic pillars of the Carolina colony was the Indian slave trade, where they were capturing Indians, selling them into slavery either as domestic slaves in the colonies or particularly to the plantation systems in the Caribbean. And they were doing this with the help and the collusion of Indian slave hunting middlemen. Tribes like the Westo and the Savannah, and particularly a group known as the Yamasee. And the Yamasee, in the Yamasee, the English found sort of the perfect counterpart. The English were ravenous to sell slaves. The Yamasee were incredibly efficient at catching them. By the 1680s and 1690s, they were decimating the Spanish mission Indians throughout Florida, I mean, all the way down to the Florida Keys. And in doing so, they were so efficient at this that they essentially dried up their supply. And they found themselves on the cusp of a dilemma that had occurred with some of these other Indian slave-hunting middlemen like the Westos, that if you eventually became more valuable as a commodity than as a collaborator, with the English that was a bad thing. The Westos, when they had trouble catching more slaves, were simply enslaved themselves.
Wow.
And the Yamasee were concerned about this as well. They were deeply in debt to English traders. They were unable to find enough slaves to pay off their debts. And in 1714 and 1715, the English conducted a census of the Yamasee towns along the lower Savannah River. And to the Yamasee, this seemed an awful lot like counting noses before taking everybody into slavery and selling them off. That's probably not what the English had in mind, but the Yamasee didn't wait around to find out. And so Good Friday morning in 1715, the Yamasee launched a coordinated attack across Carolina Colony, killed hundreds of settlers and traders and plantation owners, and set off what eventually became the largest pan-Indian uprising across in the entire early colonial period. Essentially, every Indian tribe from the Atlantic coast to the Mississippi and south to the Gulf turned against the English and almost succeeded in driving the English completely out of the southeastern part of what's now the United States.
Was there slavery among Indians in the northern part of what would be the United States?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right. So
absolutely.
It wasn't a north-south divide?
No, there was slavery among Indian tribes in the Pacific Northwest. This is unfortunately something that's pretty much universal in human culture throughout history.
Let me get Mike, thanks for the call. Let's get John from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. And whoops, John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Two things. I will definitely read the book. I am a teacher, and one of the things that I do is I show my students the path of Native American trails across Pennsylvania, and I show how the roads in today's Pennsylvania match many of the Native American trails. So that's one important thing. The other thing I was interested in is if you found your research any connection between African-American slaves or runaway slaves or free blacks and the Native Americans. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Sure, John. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Scott, go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. Those connections are very well documented. Like, for example, if you look at the Pequot, which was a tribe in Connecticut, in southern Connecticut, which lost a horrific war with the English colonists in the 1630s, the surviving Pequot were many of them were enslaved and taken into domestic service in New England, and over the course of generations, intermarried with many of the African slaves that were being held by the English, and then, as you say, many runaway slaves. You know, it was much easier to head for the hills and be taken in by native communities rather than trying to make it on your own. And so there's this tremendous cultural cross-pollination that occurred over the course of centuries between escaped and runaway African slaves and American Indians.
And John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Can we also assume that there was cross-pollination between Indians and whites?
Oh, absolutely. That's what makes this whole story so complex, and particularly in places like the coast of Maine, where for more than 75 or 100 years, you had a relatively stable, relatively peaceful hybrid society growing up between what was then still fairly limited English colonization and French colonization. Of course, on the French side, there was a tremendous amount of intermarriage, and you had an entire class of people who were the métis, the mixed blood French Indian society. There was intermarriage, there was commercial interaction. As one historian that I quote in the book points out, when warfare finally broke out, it was not between strangers. It was between people who shared ties of commerce and marriage and, who were deeply enmeshed with each other and really couldn't pull themselves apart even if they wanted to.
Do you think that explains the level of violence, or was conflict warfare violent anyway at this time?
Well, it really was.
It seems like civil wars are always so violent.
Absolutely. Look at the religious wars that were breaking out in Europe at the same time. But one of the things that I think drove this was that, as we talked before, this notion of power centers that are losing control over their people. The colonial governments were worried that the colonists in the back parts, as they called the frontier, were becoming more and more like the Indians. People who hadn't heard a sermon in years, they were losing their religious and their moral and their political underpinnings. And there are many hints in the historical record that Indian leaders were worried about the same things, that that their people were becoming more and more European. Certainly, they were extremely dependent on European goods, on European technology. Within a century or so of colonization, I suspect that the ability to make a flint or a jasper arrowhead had pretty much completely died out, because it's so much more efficient to use a musket. It's so much more efficient to use a metal axe rather than a flint hatchet. And so, the Indian societies were dependent on the colonists. The colonists were dependent to a somewhat lesser extent on the Indians.
Let me get some more callers in. We have looks like Ruth from Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And Ruth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm really enjoying the show, and
thank
I'm
you.
Wondering, Scott, you've mentioned Maine, you've mentioned Pennsylvania. How has your research dug up stories of these interactions between the Native Americans and the settlers, Swedish and English, in New Jersey? And I know William Penn also had some influence there.
Oh, absolutely.
Indeed, thanks, Ruth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
And that's a good point. We've been talking mostly about the English and a little bit about the French, and I mentioned the Spanish, but of course the Swedes were early colonists here, the Dutch were early colonists here. Further south in the Americas, the Portuguese were very involved. Virtually every European country was trying to plant some sort of a toehold in the New World in the early years, and the Swedes and the Dutch, One of the stories I tell in there is just, when Peter Minuit, we associate him with the purchase of Manhattan, but he sailed up the Delaware River and down in Delaware, sat down with the sachems of the leaders of the Lenape and drew up this really wonderfully legalistic document in which he, so far as he was concerned, was buying a big chunk of land along the Delaware River, and, for which he paid. And we talk about, dismissively about beads and trinkets. From a Native perspective, these were wonderfully valuable, rare items. And so, we can't be too dismissive about that. But nevertheless, the Lenape sachems had no idea that they were actually selling land. The idea of selling land was something that was relatively foreign to them. They saw these as gifts that were being given for the temporary use of the land. And it really infuriated many of the Europeans when the Indians would come back months or years later and ask for a renewal of those gifts because, by God, from their perspective, they'd already sold them the land. Now, by the time you get into the middle 1600s, I mentioned the coast of Maine. When you read the Indian deeds that were drawn up at those times, it's clear by that point the Indians understood what was going on. They were being very careful to maintain some of their traditional rights. That they were selling the land to such and such an English colonist. However, they would still have the right to farm their traditional farm plots along the lower reaches of the river, and that the English were not allowed to put any kind of weirs that might block the passage of migratory fish like salmon and shad further upriver. And they began to play the European game of outlining what their rights were under these deeds. Now, of course, the Europeans frequently just ignored those rights, but nevertheless, the Indians by that point had learned the hard way what land sales actually meant.
Let me ask you about another part of the story, which are the Wapanagi Indians. This was again in this early 1600s, captured, but taken to Europe.
That's right. Well, these are five Wapanagi. The Wapanagi Confederacy, the Abenaki, the Penobscot, the Maliseet along the coast of Maine. In 1605, George Weymouth, who was an English captain, anchored on what is now Muscungus Bay and captured five Wapanagi to take back to England, because the English at that point were pretty far behind the colonial curve and they needed information. And so they kidnapped these men intentionally, took them back, pumped them for information. And remarkably enough, given the fact that most natives had very little resistance to European disease, most of them that were taken to Europe died very quickly. At least four of these men, eventually made it back to the New World, including a man named Tetonato, who was eventually, he later befriended John Smith. He was John Smith's guide in that early 1600s expedition. The idea was that these men would come back and serve as middlemen on behalf of the English and help them with their commerce. They really had very little interest in that. They'd been kidnapped. They'd been taken to a different part of the world. They finally made it back to their homes and their families, and they really were not interested in acting as unpaid go-betweens for the English.
So they just sort of disappeared into the New World?
Well, eventually, although one of them may well be the man that we know today as Samoset. who showed up. You know, we know that he was, the Samoset was from the coast of Maine. He showed up down with the Pilgrims, speaking perfectly good English and asking if they had beer. but there were actually, Marty, there were thousands and thousands of natives, starting in the early 1500s, that were taken either against their will or often at their own request back to Europe. Men like Manteo, who was a Werowance, a leader along the what's now the Outer Banks of North Carolina, that traveled back to England twice, in his eyes at least, as a representative of his society and of his mm-hmm. leaders, to learn more about these strange new people. Again, these are not passive actors on the stage of history. These were men and women who were making decisions, you know, the reasons for that often lost to history, but making decisions that seemed the best for them at the time.
And we're nearly out of time here. How much of that first frontier, as was seen, you know, 400 years ago, how much of that still exists?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we think about the frontier, we think about, you know, Conestoga wagons going
Absolutely.
Across the Platte, but every foot of land here in the East was the frontier. And so you can go to places like the remains of Fort Dietrich Snyder or Fort Northkill up along the Kittatinny Ridge, the line of forts that were built by Benjamin Franklin at the beginning of the Seven Years' War. There's no physical sign of those places left, but the woods still look very much the same. The bird song is the same that you would have heard. You can visit the homestead of a person like Conrad Weiser near Wommelsdorf in Berks County and see Weiser's burial site surrounded by the graves of some of his Indian friends that had requested to be buried there. So the frontier is still there if you scratch a little bit below the surface.
Well, as always, Scott, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times once again.
It's always a pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Scott Weidensall's latest book is called The First Frontier, subtitled The Forgotten History of Struggle, Savagery, and Endurance in Early America. He writes about natural history, and he's also a bird migration field researcher. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Emily Bryant, the intern for Radio Times. Fred Snyder, our engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.